Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Welcome everyone to the General Council meeting. I first acknowledge the Kaurna people, the traditional custodians of this land, and we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Everyone is advised that the audio of this General Council meeting will be recorded and will be made available on the City of Marion website. I now ask ask elected members if there are any declarations of interest, and I'm going to put my hand up initially and say that I'm a member of Club Marion. I've paid my $20. I mention it for the sake of completeness, but I don't consider it a material interest which bears on the debate. So, Manager of Governance, do you want to say anything about that? Councillor Piper.
Thank you, Your Worship. I've got a possible or perceived interest in the SA Water acquisition due to my employment.
Right, so for members of the public, this just means that the relevant member may leave the room for that particular item. Councillor Pryor.
I've got a possible or perceived conflict of interest with the confidential motion tonight.
Very well. We may not get to it, but see how we go. Very well. Now, I need to say something about the formalities of the council business regulations. They say that adjourned matters are dealt with before any other business. Now, that becomes quite stupid because if we're about to debate the poker machines in council-owned facilities, for example, means that we debate the matter before we hear from the deputations. See what I mean? That's stupid. So what I am going to do is invite someone, if they wish, to move a motion to put things in what I suggest are a suitable order. Now, bear in mind that we have 5 deputations to be heard, 6 deputations to be heard near the beginning of the meeting, and from SA Water was effectively a deputation withdrawn, or a request for deputation withdrawn, on the basis that the spokesperson for SA Water would be available later in the meeting to answer questions when we deal with that item, which is actually a sensible way of going about it. So what I'm suggesting to people, do we have it up on the screen there? Yep. So what I'm suggesting is that we deal with the deputation from Annie Doolan's cottage, because it's not linked to any motion, and in a sense we learn from that, and then that's dealt with. And then deal with the 4 Pokies deputations, and then deal with the motion, and then move on to the dog park issue by hearing from resident Michelle Dyer, and then dealing with that motion. And then we get back into the swing of the usual agenda for the Oaklands Crossing report. So it's up to you, members. Councillor Telfer? So move. Seconded Councillor Piper. All those in favour? That's carried unanimously. So I'll call on Elizabeth Hunt to speak to us in relation to Annie Doolan's cottage. A wonderful historic cottage behind the Catholic Church. Please come forward. You have 5 minutes, including question time, so bear that in mind.
Thank you. Good evening, Your Worship and councillors. My name is Elizabeth Hunt. I'm the chairperson of the Friends of Annie Doolan's Cottage Management Committee. Members of our committee have come here tonight to acknowledge and affirm the significance of the council and their support of the cottage. For those who do not know the history of the cottage, it was built in 1876 as a convent for the Sisters of St Joseph, an order founded by Blessed Mary MacKillop, the nuns taught school in the back of St Anne's Chapel in Finnis Street. It was the first school in the area. After the nuns left in the 1890s, Two more rooms were added to the cottage and the Doolan family moved in, becoming caretakers for the chapel. The cottage was later named after Annie, who was the last family member to reside there until the 1960s. After she left, the cottage fell into disrepair. In 1995, the Marian Council realised the heritage value of the cottage, and because the Catholic Church was unable to assist with financial support and ongoing maintenance, the City of Marian entered into a lease agreement with the church. It was considered to be an ideal site for the Interpretive Centre for Marian's Heritage, as it is located in the heart of what was once the Marian Village. A land care and environment action project group rebuilt the brickwork and refooted the building. The building was listed on the City of Marian Local Heritage Register and maintained by council. I am told council had estimated it would cost $30,000 per annum to maintain and decided to hand management over to a community group. In July 2000, the first public meeting was held and formed the Friends of Annie Doolan's Cottage. The Friends are now the leaseholders and the lease has just been renewed for a further 3 years. Maintenance and caretaking of the cottage has been carried out by a small but dedicated group of members, and the cottage has now been turned into an interesting place to visit, showcasing a classroom of the 1860s, a kitchen of the 1950s, and housing the model of the village of Marian as it was in 1949. This model was commissioned by the City of Marian and located in the cottage in 2003. An annual payment is made to the Friends by the Council for storage of this model. Visitors to the cottage are interested to see how the area has grown from glass houses, market gardens and pug holes to the residential hub that it is today. The cottage has been part of the village walks, observing the many places of interest in the history of the village of Marian. School groups also visit the cottage, and children are fascinated by the teaching implements and equipment that are found in the classroom, different to what they have today. Only a slate to write on and a blackboard for the teacher is far from what they have available to them. Some years ago, the building was infested with white ants, but after repairs, treatment and regular inspections, to date this is under control. The committee is very proud of their efforts put in to make the cottage an interesting and informative place to visit. In an effort to raise community awareness of the cottage, we are very grateful for the assistance that has been given to us by Richard Watson, Publications Officer of the City of Marian. The next edition of the City Limits will carry an article highlighting the cottage and its activities. Richard has also given us other ideas for promoting the cottage. We thank Council for their previous support and we look forward to a continuing partnership in the future. Thank you.
In accordance with the resolution we just passed, we turn to the item, we turn to the deputations concerning poker machines, and I don't think there was any great science to it. We put them down in terms of first come, first served. So we've got Mr. Bruce Wright, Treasurer and General Manager of the Marian RSL, to address us. So please come forward. Each of the speakers has the 5 minutes, but if finishing early, then we've got time for questions. Thanks, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Worship. Councillors and interested members of the public, I've been a member of the Marion RSL Club now for almost 10 years, so I'm a relative newcomer. The Marion RSL has been in its present location for over 50 years. Before that, it existed behind the old council chambers in the tin shed, and before that in an area down near the Oakland Railway crossing. So we've been part of Marion Council area since just after the end of World War II. For our first 50 years in the new building, or it was new 50 years ago, we were on a peppercorn rent which went for the whole 50 years. Then 4 years ago, council decided that peppercorn rents were no longer viable, and we were placed on a 5-year lease with a current rental of some $1,300 a year. So a bit more than the peppercorn, but not much. We initially installed the 10 poker machines after votes at annual general meetings of the club, and we did that back in the 80s when the poker machines first became viable in South Australia. The members attending that meeting saw the machines as a form of entertainment as well as a way of raising funds to support the club. Approximately 5 years ago, after a special general meeting, the club surrendered 2 of those 10 licences, and so we currently have 8 poker machines. As I'm sure you're aware, our club operates as a sub-branch of the state RSL, and as such we have the same charter as the state branch, and that charter is to ensure that programs are in place for the well-being, care, compensation and commemoration of serving and former Defence Force members and their dependents, and promote government and community awareness for a secure, stable and progressive Australia. We at the club took this to the next level and decided we should become more of a community club and try to involve as many local groups as possible with the club. We've done this by offering facilities at extremely reasonable rates, and the whole area of the club is now used by exercise classes, preschool ballet, and special interest groups such as the South Australian Nepalese Society. So every weekday there is something going on and special functions on weekends. Our bowling green is used by a diverse range of groups, from school children to Resthaven residents, and also some of our own bowlers. We also provide facilities to the National Malaya Borneo Timor Veterans Association of South Australia at no cost, so that their members can meet on a regular basis for companionship and support. The final part of our welfare activities is the provision of a trained welfare pensions officer, who has his own separate and private office to meet with veterans who require assistance. We fund this by a combination of activities, with money coming from donations, fundraising such as trading tables, sale of vegetables that are grown by one of our members, meat tray raffles, pot of gold game, and of course poker machines. Of these activities, poker machine returned almost twice as much as all the other activities. It's important to note that we are primarily a volunteer club. The only wages we pay are for a bar manager and currently 3 casual bar staff who do most of the evening or night work. The bar is manned by volunteers during the day, and the management of the club is conducted on a purely volunteer basis by myself as treasurer manager, a volunteer secretary, and of course a volunteer president, with an all-volunteer committee. These volunteers have an active interest in who comes to the club, and we do take our responsibilities to our members very seriously. We actively monitor players at poker machines and always involve them in a short conversation every time they visit the club or play the machines, so we have a very good idea of their circumstances. If we were to lose the income from the poker machines, I cannot see any way of replacing those funds, as we are already doing everything possible to raise enough money to maintain the club. And although it may take a few years, the only possible outcome will be a significant downgrading or possibly an end to the Marion RSL. Thank you.
That was just a shade over 5 minutes. I think we'd better keep moving. Thanks, Mr. Wright. And I'd like to acknowledge the presence of the President of the RSL at Marion, Trevor Chapman, as well. Thanks for coming on, Mr. Chapman. So that's all for now. Thank you. And I'll call Mr. Darryl Gray from the Marion Sports and Community Club to come forward. And I see he's there with the General Manager, Craig Virgo, tonight as well. And while Darryl was just getting ready, I'll just make a comment about relevance here, because strictly speaking, the motion that we're going to address is about whether to call for a report or not. But the fact is that the matter's already been debated in the media and amongst ourselves as if it was about the substantive issue. So I'm taking a very broad approach to relevance. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Gray, thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Chris. I've tried to time myself, and it's gone from anything from 3 minutes to about 20 minutes, but I'll get 5 for you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address not only the council members, but obviously a fair number of interested people in the community. What I'm attempting to do is present what the actual club has done for the community, as well as what our future is, and also just a quick brief report as to what the effect would be if we didn't have the machines. With regards to the, just before going on with it, I was a little confused and did actually ask Chris the other day. I'm a little confused that if pokies weren't allowed, would that be the first step of, say, keno not being allowed? Would lotteries not be allowed? And perhaps more dangerous subjects like alcohol and cigarettes, if they would not be also allowed, I would tend to think that that would obviously be the completion of a whole lot of the club and many clubs in the district. I'd like to get some sort of idea as to what goes on there. The other part, I was also not too sure whether it's a local government type situation. As Mr. Xenophon, or Senator Xenophon, said last Wednesday on the 7:30 report, he said it's a national problem and it should be approached nationally. And I think it's an exceptional idea. What we're trying to do is look after the people that do have a problem with gambling, alcohol, drugs, etc. But it is really a national problem. But quickly, with regards to the history of the club, for those unaware, 107 years ago in 1908, 13 members of the Marion District purchased the land across the road, and they set up a club, and it was called the Marion Sports Community Club, of which the agenda was for the promotion of sports and recreation in the district. That continued. They had the club, well, they had that area up until the last World War. That land was then handed back to council, and then it was leased from the council from that period of time. Since that period of time, there's just been a series of leases, the one of which now will be finished in 30th of June next year. During the course of that latter period of time, the club has always been volunteers anyway, but we've really dealt deeply to make sure that we're a self-sufficient club. We don't have to continually come back to council and say, look, we need this, we need that, can you do this for us, etc. And of course, one of the means of the operations of making ourselves self-sufficient was, of course, taking up the offer of poker machines when they became available. We also were fully aware, did a lot of research into it, and thought you've either got to be right in or right out of the situation. We took the situation of going, we have to be full bore at it, and set up what we've got. In doing so, over the period of time, we've grown perhaps not the best design club around the place because of the little add-ons that we've had, but we've done the best that we can. During that period of time, though, the last lot of extensions we did was based around the fact that we were trying to take away the pokies from the general public area. So what we did is we relocated them downstairs, and they were set aside from the rest of the operations of the club. And so those that wanted to play the pokies were quite free to play the pokies. It didn't interfere with anyone else going on, so much so that when the Channel 7 came across last week to have a look, they went through the place and they said, well, we're about to see your pokies. And they had to take them back downstairs and show them where they were. So, that's the one which it is for those that haven't been there. I mentioned with that that the poker machines come in, and there was a lot of consideration of how it was set up. The same sort of consideration goes towards the staff that we employ. Currently we've got 40-odd staff working full-time or part-time, and they're all fully trained in the latest methods of handling people that do have a problem with either gambling or alcohol. Just quickly on that, of course, if we were to take out our machines out of this particular area or out of the club, it would still leave 8 venues within a 3-mile or 3-kilometre radius of this location here. That's a total of in excess of 300 machines. The whole 300 machines plus are all privately owned or company owned, none of which put back any significant value back into the community. So we are the only club that really does support the community that way. Again, if you were to take them out of our one and only venue, or the one and only venue that does return back to the community, it's not really going to solve the problem, gambler problem. Everything just remains exactly the same. The only one thing that does happen is all the Woolies and the Hurleys, etc., laugh their head off because they've then got the opportunity to take those problem gamblers under their wing and take it out of them. I was going to rattle off the number of sports that we support all the way through the community, and I was also going to say that there was a concern with regards to our viability. To explain, we have 40 machines. Each of those machines has got an entitlement of $300,000 approximately. That just gives us something in the order of around about a $1.5 million asset value of the actual machines. So if we were to get into strife, what would happen was those liabilities or entitlements, I should say, would be taken back by the bank, sold, and that would be the end of the story. So council would never have a problem with being caught with machines in their possession. It just would not possibly, it is not feasible for it to actually occur.
Politician, I don't intend to speak for very long, because I'd like to take some of your questions. Can I just say, it is a national problem, but it's also a local problem. And there's a great saying that all politics is local, and I think that this motion could be very useful in dealing with a very important issue. This is not about whether you have pokies or not, whether there ought to be a report to consider it or not. And there is a big difference between the two. Can I just say that based on the research I've seen, the researchers I've spoken to, in South Australia there are conservatively 20,000 people with a severe gambling problem on poker machines. In this council area, that would equate to about 1,200 people. We know from the Productivity Commission that meant for every problem gambler, there are 7 people affected. That means there are equivalent to about 9,000 people, about 10% of the population of the city of Marion, that are directly affected because of a gambling addiction on poker machines. That cannot be ignored. I hear the arguments from the clubs about the work that they do. I hear their arguments in terms of what the benefit that the hotels could gather. But I suggest to you, by looking at this issue seriously, only good will come out of it. If you have not already seen the brilliant documentary, Kaching Pokey Nation, that was on the ABC just a few days ago, it's about the machines. It's not about the good people that run these clubs. It's about the machines and how addictive they are. If you support this motion, it will mean that there can be a considered look about the role that local government can have, because if all politics is local, I suggest to you that looking at this issue seriously in a considered way may lead to a number of positive solutions to reduce the level of harm, so that you no longer have 10,000 people in this community that are hurting right now because of poker machines. I'm very happy to take your questions.
Senator Xenophon Timgard, I'm thankful for your view and perspectives as far as the issue of reports versus action. That certainly does clarify it to all. My single question is whether in the process, were we to pass this motion tonight to look into the depths of the machines. Are you able to counsel us on method and sources for such research? This is not something that we would be taking lightly by any means.
The short answer is yes, but also you need to hear from the industry and from the clubs. There's currently a case before the Liquor and Gambling Commission, of which I am a party, so I need to be a bit circumspect in what I say about that, but there's been a lot of very useful evidence that's come out, including evidence that's now part heard of Dr. Charles Livingston, one of the leading gambling researchers in this country. What I suggest to you is that if the council does support this motion, as I hope you will, you also need to look at what the effects will be on hotels as to whether they are an unintended beneficiary, but it also begs the question whether the council can have a positive policy of helping people, not in a direct sense, but allowing people to know where they can get help, because the Senate inquiries I've been on are that only about 10 to 15% rather of people with a gambling problem actually get help for it. Now, if as a result of passing this motion and you look closely at this issue, you can increase the number of people in your community getting help, unambiguously that would be a good thing. And I think that the industry itself, the clubs itself, wouldn't have any objection to those being hurt by the machines getting help. That would be a useful exercise. So I'm happy to be part of a process. I think it would be a great exercise. And, of course, the industry and the clubs need to be involved as well.
Thank you for coming tonight, Senator Xenophon. I do appreciate it. I would like to enrich my motion. We've had, in the fullness of time since the matter was adjourned, I've managed to speak to a lot of people, including Reverend Donald and yourself. I'm particularly interested in the harm minimisation aspect that I may well be able to embed in this report. I'd like to know a little bit more about how a report to this council, as an aside to ways of weaning clubs off poker machines, with the addition of harm minimisation strategies that we can work with the clubs and the community to actually bring about.
Well, I think that you can, if there's going to be any harm minimisation, it should also include the hotels and the powers that the council may have, at the very least to inform people of their ability to get help for a gambling problem and to be part of the broader debate. I think this council can show a leadership role in a positive way, taking into account the views of the clubs as well. So I think the motion is broad enough to do that, but obviously that is a matter for you, councillor, as to whether it ought to look at issues of harm minimisation. And as an abundance of caution, you may wish to do that. But I think that looking at issues of how do you reduce the harm within the current framework would be very useful.
As someone who's well respected in the community, and you have the title of the oxymoron of a very most trusted politician, how do you think is the best way to approach this and approach change? Because I think the issue that's happened here is the way that this has come out has created a lot of alarm in the community, especially by the people who are directly affected. So what do you think is the best approach to work with clubs, work with organisations within our local government sphere to get the outcome that you'd like to see and most of us would like to see of harm minimisation, but also making sure that there is an anxiety in the clubs and they can continue?
Well, firstly, most trusted politicians, I don't have that much competition. Secondly, in terms of the issues, obviously you need to hear fairly from all the people concerned, including problem gamblers, and also if the hotels would be a beneficiary of this being executed the report. This is just about a report. You need to consider about all the pokies venues in this area being more responsible and people getting help when they need it, given that only a fraction of the people who've got a problem are getting help. So I think you start with a starting block as that. If you achieve nothing else than to increase the number of people getting help with a gambling problem and fewer people are hurt in your community, you've actually had a big win for your community.
Your Worship, councillors and guests and members of the community, good evening. I wish to begin by expressing my appreciation to the Marion Council for making a commitment to fly the rainbow flag. I commend you for thinking deeply about making decisions that reflect on the well-being of your community. And I also appreciate your willingness or your considering to look at another complex issue within your community. My name's Peter McDonald. I'm a Uniting Church minister and I work for Uniting Communities. We seek to strengthen communities and we see the impacts of poker machines on individuals and communities. And we would, if you invited us to, want to be engaged in a conversation about harm minimisation options. Uniting Communities works across South Australia. We have about 90 community service programs throughout all of South Australia. Our services are across the state, including women, people within your council area here in Marion. So we're an organisation that sees the impact of gambling and gaming on individuals, on families and on communities and what that means for us. Gambling, especially poker machine gambling, impacts adversely on communities in a number of ways, including the detrimental impacts on local people who live with an addictive gaming behaviour, adverse impacts to family members, as Senator Xenophon's pointed out, that extends out to at least seven people within the local family and extended network, and it often includes children. It also contributes to negative economic impacts around money spent on poker machines because of the lack of a multiplier that goes on when money goes into local businesses or local businesses. The multiplier effect is much stronger in those spaces. As you've already heard, but I want to emphasise the Productivity Commission. So this is not a body that's being led by the gaming industry or the concern sector. It's a report done set by an independent organisation. The Productivity Commission in 2010 stated that 40% of gambling revenue from electronic gaming machines comes from people with a gaming addiction. That is 40% of people who 40% of gaming revenue comes from people who have gaming issues or concerns. There are other key findings in the Productivity Commission report as well, that poker machines, and this is, I guess, our concern, is out of all the forms of gaming, poker machines is the one that accounts for 70 to 80% of problem gamblers. So this is why the concern sector gets focused on poker machines as opposed to keno or the other varieties of things, is because of the problem gambling that's connected to that matter. And of course the social costs of gaming are wide, including suicide, depression, relationship breakdowns. And all of this work, there's been thorough research done on this, empirical research for many years around this area, and we can back this up with examples from people who've experienced the damaging effect of gaming machines. I had a quick look at the local government area numbers that are taken from the Consumer and Business Affairs, and it shows that out of the 44 local government associations in South Australia, the area that has the highest level of net gaming revenue is the City of Port Adelaide. And you may already know, or you may not know, that the City of Marion comes in at ninth out of the 44 local government areas in net gaming revenue. So in a way, the City of Marion has comparably high levels of gaming spend, which means higher levels of gaming harm and compared to others. I would commend to you the opportunity to explore this issue within the area of the report. We wish to encourage the City of Marion to investigate ways of reducing gaming harm, and this will increase community well-being and local economic activity, as well as reducing the substantial harm experienced by people with gaming problems to their friends and family. The Productivity Commission's report recommends, for example, one of the things you could explore is, it recommends a $1 maximum per bet spin limit. A $1 maximum per spin bet limit. So one of the things you could explore is, we would put to you that may not impact on recreational gamblers, but it will be a budgetary constraint for those with gambling problems. The Productivity Commission recommends this as a way forward, as something to be considered, and I would offer that as a part of that conversation. Thank you. Uniting Communities just remains open to working with you in this area.
Mr. Mayor, just in a... Point of order, there is a motion in this agenda relating to poker machines at the end. Why cannot we deal with that now while everybody's here?
Because I'm running the meeting and the council just resolved to deal with issues in a certain order, and so that's the order we're stuck with.
Well, Michelle, welcome, and please let us know your concerns or information about the dog park, and know that you have 5 minutes. If you finish early, there'll be time for questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Your Worship. Thank you for allowing me to address my concerns regarding the proposed dog park at Trott Park. I reside next door to the park, having moved to Adelaide from the country in 1998. The decision to move to this area was largely due to the fact that there were many reserves in the area and it was close to beaches. Living next door to the park allowed for our children to play in the playground on the equipment, play ball games, throw the frisbee, fly kites, learn to ride their bikes and kick the footy around. The introduction of the barbecue and picnic facilities meant an increase in the use by families, with many families often utilising the area for their children's birthday celebrations. With generous room for children to play and run about, etc., families could enjoy the relaxed, family-friendly environment undisturbed. To place a dog park at a family-friendly reserve is asking for trouble. Whilst one would expect that dog owners are responsible and have effective control of their pets, we know this is not often the case. To put children and families at risk of a dog attack or overzealous greeting from a dog is just too great. Dog parks have become extremely popular and owners are not having to increase their responsibility for their dogs. If anything, it creates lazy pet owners who place their dogs in these enclosures and allow them to run wild, often to the detriment of other dogs and their owners. Dog parks, if used properly, are about owners supervising their dogs and ensuring the safety of all others using the enclosure. To place a dog park at a family picnic playground area is just asking for trouble. Are the parents supervising their dogs or their kids on the play equipment? Or are they just dog owners socialising at the barbecue, blissfully unaware of what their dog is doing in the enclosure? Adams Road is very busy, and despite the 50-kilometre speed limit and the roundabout, will often speed up and down the street. The increased traffic to an already busy road is fraught with danger. Parking along Adams Road is minimal, and residents already have difficulties when reversing out their driveways due to the cars parked in the street impairing their vision. Having a dog park located next to houses decreases the value of these houses. Would you want to live next door to a dog park? I know I certainly didn't when I bought my home, nor did I expect that the beautiful park next door would ever become a dog park. I feel that my privacy would be compromised. I know that my pets would become distressed to the sounds and smells of the frequent visitors to the park, as I'm sure my neighbours would agree. The additional visitors to the park will produce noise, rubbish and smells, further impacting on residents, especially those that do shift work. As the park is located on a slope, Watering a lawn area would be fruitless. The soil is clay-based and well-known for its large cracks during the dry months. Prickles and burrs are a constant issue with seeds from the nearby horses' grazing paddocks blowing across. Knowing all this, as a ratepayer, I would be very annoyed at paying for the maintenance of the dog park when this location is not at all suitable or sustainable. It has been mentioned that with further future funding and grants, the potential for lighting, seats and shade would be installed. This will only further increase the noise and attract vandalism and loitering. If it's about infrastructure, or a more commonly understood term, money, then I believe the council should seriously consider their options. The park is great as a family park. Why spoil that? Dog parks need to be away from residential housing. They need to be well thought out and not just a quick fix because of an election promise. Consider your ratepayers. I'm one of them. In addition to this, I would just like to reiterate that when this proposal first came to our attention, we spoke with members of the council who assured us they would look at other options. Instead, they adjusted the size of the park enclosure, making it larger, and despite mapping designs, insist it has been moved further away from our fence line. We insisted at the time that we did not want the enclosure next door, yet here they are proposing to have it next door. We feel like we have been tricked by allowing us to think a new location would be sought. If we had known this was not the case, we would have petitioned and planned further action to ensure the park would not go ahead next door. All reports and feedback from neighbouring residents to all dog parks from any council area are of the same thoughts. No one wants a dog park next to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Worship. I'm moving the motion with option 3 as the proposed option. Did you want someone to second it? Thank you, Worship. There's been a long consultation process with this proposed dog park, and part of the process has been that we've surveyed residents, we've visited with residents, I've been at the local shops talking to people, and I've been in the actual reserve talking to people walking their dogs in the reserve. When we visited with residents, we actually did walk the park with the residents, talking about where it would be better suited in the park from the original plan that was put out. The very first early version of option 1 was very small. There was problems with the smallness, with the slope of the ground, proximity to the houses, and that there was an airlock to be next to the houses. So these were the initial problems that we did look at. One of the things with the size, a lot of people were telling me how they commended Marion on the size of Hazelmere Park as being the right size for a dog park. Even though that is not an official dog park, people saw that as that Marion had done something great in that particular park. The size that we were looking at Trott Park was about a third of that size, and most people were telling me that they would not use it in that location and that size, that they'd actually walk around it to the other side of that fence park and use more of the reserve on the other side and up into the O'Halloran Hill Recreation Park. So our initial intention had been to look at a large park with fencing similar to that at Hazelmere Park. However, we were dictated to by the insurance companies to a lot of that, in that we had to have a minimum height of 1.8 metre high fence with a bar top and bottom to stop dogs jumping the fence or digging under it, even though we're not actually providing doggy daycare and owners are with their dogs. Also, there had to be airlock entrances to the park. The slope of the ground that was there that I talked about before. Yes, if anyone had thrown a ball for their dog, they would have run down the park. It would have been very annoying for the neighbours. And we totally agreed that that 5 metres difference between houses and the dog park was not appropriate, particularly as you have horses going through that area as well, and we needed to make sure that that was allowed for. So the plans now are that there is to be a 30-metre gap with extra plantings of plants in there, and the airlocks have moved to be more appropriate so it is not impinging on owners' properties. So we have tried to look at that in detail. We also had a expert dog person, who designs parks and has been very involved with this in Australia and overseas, and she came and gave a lot of advice on the positioning of the dog park there, what should be done with vegetation and plantings and the different terrain. So that's all right. I'll hand over to Councillor Christie.
Thank you. So just to follow on from Councillor Byram, as I say, we had an expert dog designer that actually assisted with the design of this dog park. The only other thing that councillors will probably want to learn about is the budget. Initially, we were trying to design a dog park with $100,000 and stick to the $100,000. In effect, that just wasn't possible, particularly with the fencing and the airlocks. The dog park that we're recommending is the one which is actually fit for purpose. I personally believe we've accommodated all the residents' concerns that were raised, other than completely removing it to another reserve. Just to answer Ms. Dyer's question there, the reserves were fully researched before Reserve Street Dog Park was actually decided upon. So at no stage from that point were we looking at other reserves, and Reserve Street was always the preferred location. The new location and size of the dog park helps with car parking, because there's three different entrances to the dog park, which means that traffic can approach the dog park from three different areas. I think that's probably final. Thank you.
May I ask a question? Would that also include that it's actually a poodle-only area with Gucci collar and coat?
I believe the staff have an alternate motion. I'd like to move that motion if possible.
typo in paragraph 2, we have one less bracket than we want, and it could actually affect the meaning. So after option 4, we need a second bracket. Thank you. Prior to speak to the motion? Yes, take it. A question?
Can people see option 4? Because it wasn't in the original agenda, so I just wondered if it could be put on the screen for people to see. I've seen it, but I just don't know if everybody's seen it.
That's a good point. Are we able to put that on the screen? In fact, instruction to staff generally that where there are options, probably all of the options need to be spelled out in the actual words of the motion.
Mr. Clark has copies of the options if required for other members.
Mr. Clark, do you have multiple copies of option 4? Thank you. Well, I think with leave of the meeting, we'll distribute them during the meeting. And I'd like one as well. I'm not sure I've seen it. But meanwhile, perhaps if you'd like to start addressing us, Councillor Pryor. Thank you.
Absolutely. The Oaklands Crossing has been at a point of debate for quite a long time, is my understanding. There's a lot of feeling in the community about this. There's a lot of feeling around the council about this. Something needs to be done. That's pretty much what we're getting from everyone. Something needs to be done. We're not sure what yet. That's the interesting part of the question. So this intersection creates congestion through our area. It's causing a lot of issues throughout our ward and our neighbouring ward, in particular some traffic issues. And I'd like to refer to some of the previous motions we've got to spend some money to address these issues. We're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to put in traffic calming devices to address some of these problems. It kind of puts the $46,000 or $47,000 in perspective that we're planning to spend on the Oaklands Crossing here. Doing the Oaklands Crossing and doing a good job of the Oaklands Crossing will result in a large economic benefit to our city. That's pretty clear from talking to pretty much anyone. Getting rid of traffic congestion, something which affects a lot of people. A lot of people transit twice a day through that crossing with waits up to 15 minutes. It's really not acceptable for kind of a little side street, really. The other point to this motion is that we'd be campaigning on two levels, and that is a community awareness campaign, and most of the community are already aware, but we'd be looking for those members of the community to give us support to move forward with this and talk to their local members as well to garner some support. This is also a chance for us to go to our politicians, our local politicians, our state politicians, and convince them that there's a need in this area to address this intersection. Lastly, the potential of fixing this intersection, definitely going to create jobs, particularly in the area. It's a big project. Thank you.
Thank you. I was happy to allow Councillor Pryor move this motion. His contribution to the matter is widely known and appreciated, Mr. Mayor. And I knew we were going to get a seconder for the motion by doing so. This has been around for a long time. The previous council did a pretty good job on this with a petition, a fairly big petition that was presented to Parliament. There was a campaign. I wanted the billboards back then. I may well have them tonight as part of option 4, which is fantastic. Members, much to Councillor Gard's credit, there's a question on notice in this very agenda about the possible effects to emergency services with this crossing, and it's a point well recognised by Councillor Gard, and the question is a good one. That's one angle. There's multiple angles. There's the impact on our economics in the area as well. You know, Christ the King School, for example, know that it impacts on their attendance because the railway line is a barrier for enrolments. And even Westfield will privately tell you that they find it as an economic impediment for them. So in terms of this motion, if this gets through tonight, it's fantastic in taking it up at the political level. We in Marion are in a competitive environment. We are competing with every other level crossing in metropolitan Adelaide in terms of wanting it fixed. We're also competing with, for example, the City of Prospect, who wants a new tram line to go there. So if we don't beat the drum and actually wave the flag, we're going to get overlooked. And we shouldn't be overlooked because, Mr. Mayor, 30 years ago on the MATS program, this railway crossing was earmarked to be addressed, 30 years ago. And here we are still waiting for it. And in that 30 years, the traffic has increased, the intensity of our footprint has increased, and it's going to increase more with the new Westfield application that's in the pipeline. We've got a new state aquatic centre. We've got a state facility right alongside this now. It really deserves attention. And if we don't take it up to them, it won't happen. The last part of the motion, that we reserve the right to escalate the campaign, is a great one, because it means the politicians don't know what our capacity is. And they don't know how far we're prepared to go to take it up in a federal or state campaign. And might I make this closing comment, Mr. Mayor, that the federal campaign is probably more important than the state campaign, because that's where the money is. And we really need to actually take it up in both those campaigns and put the local members on notice and candidates on notice that this is really important.
Councillor Hull, just a question of clarification. When you talk about MATS program, are you talking about ABC 891 in the morning?
Well, more Dave than MATS, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Thank
you. I get it. Now, is there anyone speaking against the motion? Councillor Appleby?
I'm going to speak against, Your Worship. I fully support the campaign, and I would authorise the Mayor to speak to numerous MPs in the area who, a lot of them are in marginal electorates, but I don't think we should be using ratepayers' money for political campaigns.
Speak for or against the motion?
Look, I have a reluctance to spend money on this. However, through the last campaign, this was the second largest issue brought up by people in Jerome and myself's ward. So I think that people...
Point of order, you're referring to Councillor Appleby.
Councillor Appleby. I don't mean to trivialise.
I mean, I know you're time. Close, but in a council meeting, it should be Councillor and the surname.
So I think it is something that people throughout the city are expecting us to take action on, and I think it does need a little bit... something a little bit further than just the discussions with politicians. So whilst I am reluctant in this case, based on what the community's told me, we do need to act and put our money where I guess our mouth is.
Thank you, Your Worship. Yes, I think a lot of people know how passionate I am about this. I've sent many a letter to the press and politicians about it over the years. Councillor Hull is absolutely correct in that it's 30 years overdue. That's probably conservative. Addressing Councillor Jerome Appleby's comments about the interests of the ratepayer, I feel that this is a one-out. I think the ratepayers would be delighted to contribute 50 cents each initially to have Council do a coordinated study and campaign. It is one of those really burning issues that affects many people, a major part of our economy, particularly in the Westfield shopping centre sector, and of course a lot of our own installations. And most of all, it affects the health of of people, and I quite often use the example of the poor mother who's picked the children up from school and is standing for anything up to 15 or 20 minutes in the western sun on a 46 degree afternoon with a small infant in the back seat or an elderly mother or what have you. That's just one image I paint. This is a ridiculous situation. It is being keenly addressed interstate as far as grade separations at the crossings en masse is concerned. But I would have to say, from my knowledge, and I'm a former Sydney dweller, and I know a lot of Melbourne, I would have to say, from my knowledge, that this is one of the worst cases of a crossing in Australia. So it really deserves our utmost attention.
Thank you. And just a point of clarification, it may be 40 years rather than 30 years out of date because it was in the 1975 budget, but then it slipped. Councillor Telfer?
Mine was a question relating to the second point through the chair. How large is the identified savings resulting from 2014-15 financial year? And what processes are there for divvying this identified savings golden bucket up?
Mr. Mifsud.
Through the chair, Council tonight will be looking at the year-end financial statements and adopting those statements as a matter of normal process. Once they've been adopted, the next stage is that we will, as part of the first budget review, the finance team will reconcile that cash result to the original budget, and that'll identify what the real savings are at that point in time. Whilst we don't have certainty, it looks like it's going to be in the order of about $3.5 million or thereabouts. In terms of the process, typically once the savings have been identified and brought through to council as part of that first budget review process, it has been typical practice in the past that council would allocate most, if not all, of those funds into the Asset Sustainability Reserve, and then it would be up to council through council resolution to use those funds in accordance with those reserves.
So, following question. So it is advantageous for councillors to put up many, many of these motions suggesting ways that we can spend the 2014-15 financial year funds so that we get our pet projects across the line before it goes into the Asset Sustainability Fund?
Mr. Mifsud.
Through the chair, Councillor Telfer, the normal process would be that the reconciliation of the cash surplus would be identified and validated first. That would then be moved into typically the Asset Sustainability Reserve, and then from that point forward, Council would make decisions as to how they felt those funds should be used progressively through a particular financial period, or whether they are to be held back for other strategic priorities that the Council may have.
So it sounds like we can eat of the magic pudding before or after tonight with some equity in that.
Yeah.
Councillor Telfer.
So my last one. So is it possible to fund the Oaklands Crossing grade separation from the Asset Sustainability Reserve?
That could be a yes or a no answer, Mr. Mifsud.
Through the chair, in terms of the actual the parameters of the Asset Sustainability Reserve, it normally wouldn't cover this type of expenditure. But once again, ultimately, it is a decision for Council, but it typically wouldn't cover this type of expenditure.
All right. Councillor Pfeiffer?
Thank you, Worship. Mine's more of a procedural question in relation to point four. In terms of the Local Government Act, what is the process for deeming something a benefit?
It's what we decided is. There's no definition which would guide us. It's up to our common sense and our judgment.
So therefore it comes back to another council meeting? Is that what we're saying? In which case is it necessary to have it there?
Well, you know, what elected members deem it to be, technically that would mean the council resolution, but of course whether that is prospective or could be retrospective is maybe a question.
At any rate, it's a fair comment to call that clause into question. Councillor Hull's explained a political reason for it. Question from Councillor Valeska?
Just in that final one, is it possible to... I guess the concern is that it might cost more money and we haven't... It's a bit of a blank cheque. So is it possible to qualify that it doesn't involve spending extra money?
As it is, Councillor, it doesn't involve spending extra money because it's not authorising extra money as it is. Staff are nodding in agreement with that. All right, there being no other speakers, Councillor Pryor to close the debate.
Just very quickly, I'm interested in Councillor Telfer's line of questioning, given that the original motion, this pretty much picks up the original motion and reduces the amount of money, so we're actually making a saving on the spending of the savings resulting from the financial year budget. So I'm not sure where that was going, but this is less money than we were going to spend originally. And that motion was moved by Councillor Telfer. So that was a bit an interesting line of questioning. I didn't understand that. In response to everybody else who spoke against, this is costing us money. This crossing is costing us money. We should do something about it. $47,000 is not much money. And I think this is pretty good bang for our buck. It's been pared down very well by Mr. Clark, Councillor Crossland and Councillor Hull. I think it was initially much greater than this, the money that was going to be spent on this campaign. So I'm very, very comfortable with the spending. And I'm very comfortable that we have put enough in it to get something done from a media perspective and something done from a political perspective. So I'm very happy with the motion as it stands.
The Strategic Directions Committee minutes, they appear on page 41 of your agenda. Councillor Valescu, did you wish to move that motion? Page 41 of the agenda.
Yeah, I'd like to move the motion and the report as is. I guess I'd just like to thank all the elected members, the independent members and the staff. I think that we've been able to achieve a lot in this committee. It's given us the basis to pursue some items in our new committees, both in the planning and in the strategy. I guess what I liked was I saw everyone contributing and everyone... staff and elected members together working through some of these issues. I think this process was a little bit different than in previous years, and it was really about the members and the independent members leading this, but now there's a lot more to come and there'll be a lot of contribution the staff can make as well. I was very happy with it and it was a real pleasure to chair it and I look forward to continuing some of that work, but I know that everyone around this table had a valuable contribution to make and they will continue to do so. So thank you.
Thank you. Seconded by Councillor Westwood. Did you wish to speak? Councillor Westwood.
I'd just like to support Councillor Lescue's thoughts and I look forward to working with him on similar matters.
Thank you. Councillor Hull?
I'd like to ask the question that I've asked before, only I'm looking for an indication from the administration and from yourself, Mr. Mayor, and it's in this report, whilst it's actually part of the agenda item 6.2, I draw your attention again to the bulky goods in Tonsley. I'm not going to let this go. I think it's an important issue that hasn't been picked up by the media at all. where...
And you'd like that to happen?
And I think we need to advocate for our patch, because it seems the government is drifting to the north, and I predicted this.
I can tell you two things that are relevant. One is that I think the letter has already been signed and sent by me, and it specifies to the minister that we don't want bulky goods in Tonsley. So that has happened. Secondly, I can understand the concerns about the drift to the north, or however you phrase it. When the treasurer, Tom Koutsantonis, addressed the local business group just a couple of months ago, he had a series of slides about the budget, and the page of examples of extra spend was all up in the north. And I did question him about that, about the south. But please carry on.
Well, I'm glad that you're hearing me, Mr. Mayor, because it was the same minister that said to me on site that we don't want the libs in here, Bruce, we don't want bulky white goods in Tonsil. Now, you know, this is a backflip on that, and it's a bad signal. It's a white flag. And I really think that we should be ramping this up. We've observed it. The staff have picked up on it. You've written a letter, but I think that we need to actually make this an issue so Tonsley gets the treatment it deserves. Mr. Mayor, this council can achieve a lot. You know, we've raised concern about not having a weekend service on the Tonsley line. Now, today I noticed that there is actually going to be a train service on maybe this coming Sunday for an event at Tonsley. Maybe that's a step in the right direction, and maybe we actually contributed to that. I don't know. But look, you know, the community expects us to actually advocate on their behalf. You know, it's part of our inherent expectations to actually do that. And I'm surprised that the opposition hasn't picked up on this as a point. Or maybe they think bulky white goods are fine in Thompson. And that's another question. We need to flush out their position on this as well, as much as the government's position. And, you know, it's not being party political here. It's Advocacy 101, and Tonsley, as identified by our previous acting CEO and our current CEO, has flagged this as the biggest project in our city. So it is not of insignificance to us to actually take an interest in. So I seek guidance as to how we can actually take this up as a campaign.
Seeking guidance, is that something you wish staff to take on board, on notice?
I think the staff could contribute to this as well. We've got an economic development.
Well, perhaps the best way to move forward, Councillor, as you know, next Tuesday evening we have a forum where we have senior government officials concerned with Tonsley coming to hear what we have to say about it. So I think that would be an excellent opportunity. I'll ask them to bring the flak jackets. Very well. I put the motion. All those in favour? All those... Well, I don't... There wasn't really any opposition to the motion. And I thought you spoke very well before. But in the interests of getting through our 530 pages, I'll put that to a vote. All those in favour? All those against? That's carried unanimously. And now on page 54 of the report, the audit committee minutes. Councillor Pfeiffer to move.
Thank you, Worship. I move as written. And in doing so, I note that this particular audit committee meeting was predominantly related to the year-end accounts and associated matters, of which our corporate reports for decision, quite a few of them are dealing with in the subsequent items coming up. And, of course, we also are lucky to have the chair of the Audit Committee in the gallery tonight, who will be presenting the Audit Committee annual report to Council. Thank you, Worship.
Thank you. Is that seconded? Seconded, Councillor Telfer. Did you wish to speak? No? Any other speakers? Then I'll put the motion. All those in favour? All those against, that's carried unanimously. Thank you. We now turn to the Audit Committee annual report to Council. And I think at this point, I ask Mr. Greg Connor to come forward. We're very honoured to have someone of his stature as chair of the Audit Committee, along with Catherine Presser and Lou Owens, a very capable Audit Committee we have. So Mr. Connor's come up to the front of the auditorium, and we're after someone to move. Moved Councillor Pfeiffer and seconded Councillor Valescu. I'll go to Councillor Pfeiffer first. Sorry, I'll just pause for a moment. Perhaps the best way of doing this, Councillor, is to just move item one, and in the course of the debate, perhaps again we'll seek leave to have members' salient points recorded in the minutes, and that could be the feedback for the Audit Committee. So I'll be liberal in allowing members to speak. They have issues to raise about the Audit Committee or any of the subjects they've considered. But I think that might be in a more tidy way of moving forward procedurally. So if you're happy with that, Councillor Pfeiffer, moving that point number one. And do I have leave of the meeting for those members comments to be recorded? Yes, I have leave of the meeting, so thank you for including that in the minutes. And over to Councillor Pfeiffer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I will take the audit, the report as read, and probably say as an overview that I do believe not only as chair, but the members of the committee, and also the debate and the rigour of which the matters which come to us are taken and worked through is a very professional one. I believe that the way that management and the council look at the audit committee is not only just something with a green pen to tick and click and add up the columns and make sure that they work, but also is there to give guidance and take some of their, dare I say, business expertise and work them through the agendas of the council is a really positive thing. I enjoy doing that, and I think both Lou and Catherine, the new audit lady there, does as well. So I think it's a pleasure to go through it. Like necessarily the 300-page asset management report, but I think even that now is starting to get to a very salient document with that looks at the key issues very well. So I commend the report. I believe it's a committee that I think adds value. Hopefully, from your point of view, it adds value to your operation. And happy to take any questions.
I'll turn to councillors after I've asked a question. One of the comments the Audit Committee's made is in favour of the savings that we've achieved. Now, it occurs to me that we use the word savings in the currency of our council as a necessarily positive thing, but quite often it's used to describe expenditure that was budgeted that never occurred. So call it a saving. But there's no element of efficiency involved in it. Would you like to comment on the way that the word savings used in the report?
Thank you. I think there's a whole lot of ways. And that's a key, I think, to any business, and especially the council, is to say that if you've got money left at the end of the year, then one of the things you need to do is have a reconciliation and say, well, how much of that is based on money that you were going to spend, didn't spend, still intend to spend, into the future budget year, and that really becomes a recurring expense or an expense that you need to take into account before you have a look at what the absolute money you have left over, if you like, at the end of the year is, and then you need to work out how you use that in a prudent way, whether it's best to put it in the bank and keep it for a rainy day, reduce debt, or use it for positive projects in the community. So I think there's two parts of that. There are timing issues, and absolutely I think when we talked about the asset management plan, there was a whole lot of money when you looked at it at the end of the time, and we made comment that you needed to be careful because some of that was based on some assumptions about savings, and some of it was also money that actually was earmarked for other expenses at the end of the day. So whilst you could look at the figures and say we have $80 million at the end, you need to be really careful as to how that's made up and really what you have in your pocket to be able to use for extra items. So I agree with you, savings can be... we should be clever in that when we talk about it and look at ongoing or excesses or money left that you can then use.
Telfer?
Following on from you mentioning about debt, what is your opinion on debt to do with the Cove Civic Centre and the City Services, both of which are big budget items this year, and spreading the debt to our grandchildren versus using our Treasury Council rates money in the short term?
I've just been told that I think we've, according to Vinnie, who's a lot cleverer than I am, you've already borrowed the money for Cove, but if your question is, do you borrow or use the money you have saved for projects? I don't think there's a clear answer to that. There's a number of things you need to consider. One of our members, Lou, and I think he's very eloquent and makes sense, is around where's the cost of intergenerational lending and what do you need to do now for the future and say, do the people of today's community pay for the benefit of the future? That's a debate for council. One of the ways that you can look at having options in that debate is to say, what's the best use of your money? So if I were to put my banking hat on, which has been off for a while, I think it's simple to say, if you have a project that you need to borrow $1 million for at 7%, and you have money sitting, unused money sitting, earning you 2.5% or 3%, then in the best interests of the shareholders or your community members, on that occasion, it may be best to use the money that's sitting in Treasury, because you're saving 3% on $1 million, which you don't have to find somewhere else. If it's for a longer term proposition where the concept maybe of intergenerational benefit comes in, you might look at a blending option where you say, and I'm making these up, if it's a $20 million project and it has some future benefit, but some current benefit, you may say, well, we will blend it, we will borrow 10 and use 10. And that becomes an economic debate that you have based on the project and where you sit with your financials. I'm sorry I haven't got a complete answer because I don't think there is one. It'll depend on the project.
Well, I'm going to cut in again there, excuse me, members, but I think Councillor Telfer's question, although it was couched in general terms, we have a very current issue before us where we've got debt of between 11 and 12 million in respect of those two new buildings. We authorised, the previous council authorised borrowing of up to 25 million. We probably won't need to borrow that much. But if we have unspent money sitting in the bank, and I've been told it's perhaps about 3 million, then the option for us would be to either not borrow the rest of the money to complete the city depot, which is near the end, or to borrow as planned to complete that project and leave the 3 million, if it be that, in the bank. So if we put it more specifically, does that change your answer?
No. No, again, because the parameters, Mr. Mayor, would be what you need to consider. Could you use that 3 million for something better? And if there was a way that you could leverage that $3 million in a better way, it might be better to borrow the $3 million to finish the depot. Or if you say, well, that is a logical thing, and by using that $3 million, you've saved, I'd have to put you a couple of $100,000 in interest, probably because of the length of the loan, maybe more, then it might be a smart thing to do at that point in time. You'd need to look at the math.
Councillor Gard, then Councillor Hull.
Mr. Connor, Greg, if you like. Yes. If you, if you'll accept my thanks this evening for quite a bit of education this year. I think I've been to 3 audit committees in the gallery, and I really have found it extremely beneficial, particularly as a new member. In the light of that, I took a lot of note of what Lou Owens had to say about this very subject of intergenerational sharing of burden, financial burden, and I was going to ask a similar question to Councillor Telfer. But it also occurs to me that there's the issue of planning that interfaces with the audit findings and with our financial balances and ratios. And when you're making that sort of decision, would it not be helpful, therefore, for us to consult in the strategic and business planning processes with people like yourself and Mr. Owens in to get perspective on what our powers for future development, for example, might be, in the light of it may be healthier to borrow, but if you bring another future project into account, it may not. In other words, you're starting to big picture it more and look at horizons, not just what is, when you're making that sort of decision. So that was the first question. The second question was very brief, and that is, from your knowledge of auditing within the local government sector, do you have any views as to whether we should expand the scope of our auditing to other things, perhaps more operational, for example?
Councillor Hull.
I'd like to ask you a question about a genre of auditing that I don't think has been picked up thus far. I recently attended a conference in Sydney with Energy Efficiency and Local Government, and it was pointed out to me the irony that apart from the environmental officers, the Anne Gibbons of the local government world, 50% of the audience were actually finance managers from councils. Therein is the question. Do you think there's an opportunity for a genre of auditing to be picked up by our audit committee, being energy efficiency? And also, do you think in terms of the savings that we're talking about, would it be actually a good investment to plough that some of that money back into a deficit in our system? Because in this room, we've got 1996 technology in this very room as an example in terms of lighting. Do you think it's a good investment of some of that surplus money to invest into new technologies to give us a better ongoing energy efficiency, particularly when the payback period is 2 or 3 years?
Sorry, forgot the technology. I think it's a very good question, and in previous... Well, I sit on the board of National Pharmacies that has 80 branches and a head office. And one of the things that they have done is look at their lighting. And there is an initial investment, depending on what you have and the amount of it, but their payback has been significant and probably less than a year. So you don't want to be as good as your last book that you've read or paper that you've seen, but I think there is in your strategic planning, you have a biophilic, which is about green and zero waste and those things. So I think it falls neatly into that strategic and could be something if you're looking for quick wins and ticking that box in there that you could look at as a service review. I think it does have legs, but I don't know the amount of energy. I think you've got trucks. It would be a great thing there, would be my personal view. So
thank you. Councillor Bilescu.
I just want to know the sort of caution that you would exercise in regards to the setting of rates, and maybe you can elaborate more about what could be potential funding gaps towards the end of our long-term financial plan, because we are looking to obviously have the minimal rate increases possible, but just to be able to elaborate what we need to be concerned about. And I do have one other question after that.
I think I've been through two rate-setting processes with this organisation, and the first thing is that you look at it over a 10-year period, and you need to be careful because when you go into those numbers, as I think I said before, and you look at the rate and then you look at how you look in 10 years, there are so many variables based and assumptions based on that. And if you are assuming, I don't know, a 0.5% net rate increase for 10 years in terms of, wages increase, because you believe you can get more efficient and offset and da da da, and that gives you a figure, and if that 0.5% is 1.5%, then you can change that outcome by tens of millions of dollars. So I think what you need to do when we're looking at these, and it's an iterative process, is that every year, once you know what you're doing and what's happening in society, you know, rates, the whole lot of things, when you start to do your modelling, that changes. So it's about saying, just because you say we can afford a rate of 2.5% this year and possibly next year and then it's flat, the good thing is that after a year, you've got to go back and look at it again. So that 10-year end game can always change and can be monitored by the process that you use. I just don't think that in the end of the day, if you want to be the best council and give the best services and have all these projects that you want to do, then that costs. Money doesn't grow on the trees, and the greatest amount of the income that you get is from rates. So if you just got to be consistent in your levers. If you don't want to pull the rate lever completely down, then you need to be very guarded about how far you can pull the benefit lever down. If you pull the rate lever a little bit, and you just really want a bad analogy with what was happening before, but if you do a whole lot of projects and a whole lot of everything else, then you're just going to end up in 2 to 3 years back in a red hole that you need to climb out of with more rates. So you just need to understand those levers, I think, as you do.
If we were to look at savings and ongoing savings, whether it is to put down the rates lever or to increase the benefits without increasing the rates as much, what are the sort of things that local government organisations such as ours could look at as far as the most effective and efficient way to save ongoing costs?
It's a simplish process that you need to say, well, what are your major spends? In an organisation that I was working with today, it's property and staff. So if you're going to make savings, then you look at your two major expenses and see how they can be carved or remain the same and do more with what you've got. Or if it's property, it's about making sure you get the best property deals, or you move out of Westfield and you go into the strip shops where it's cheaper. So the process would be to have a look at your major expenses and see therefore and what they deliver and say, well, if we don't do this, what's the impact? Where does that impact back on our strategic plan? What is the quality of life in Marion? Is anybody going to know? And look at those sorts of things. I also think, going back to Councillor Hull's point of view, is I think you've got some really good potential in terms of being smarter on the way you do things in that waste management area. From this position, I also chair the SWARA board, and you have a wonderful operation down there that I think can be leveraged. And the way that that's heading, I think you've got a little gold mine to come back to you properly managed.
Other questions? Councillor Kerry.
What you've got down there is it's risky, but you've employed a fellow, Mark Hindmarsh, who knows his waste. Rather than getting an administrator, you've got somebody down there. And just the things that I'm seeing that he's doing and starting to put together are amazing. I'll give you really one quick example. Have you been to the dump? No. Well, I would get him here, and I'd strongly recommend. You've got a set of sheds, probably as big as this auditorium, where methane comes out and it is sold or given to the people that run the shed, and they power turbines and put electricity back into the grid. That's been sitting there because, for whatever reason, for 10 years plus, and I think they get $7,000 a year for that. They've now had a look at it. Mark's had a look at it and said, all these big turbines, all this gas, and we're only getting 7,000. Something's not right. So he's done a study. He's renegotiated. They've got new operators coming in. You're going to get somewhere between 50 and 100,000 back. Well, there is a whole lot of other stuff that they're doing, which is going to take that dump from a potential liability to you, because you're going to have to own the capping for the next 100 years, to a place that will go on rather than being capped in 2025, it's 2050, so it's going to outlast all of us.
Councillor Pryor.
Yeah, while we're touching on a few of the strategic directions for the council, I'm interested to know your opinion of us trying to remove some of the rate burden by perhaps trying to generate some income in other areas of the council, other areas of industry, if we can. Do you have any opinions on that?
I think in a business, if you have multiple sources of income, then you've got a more sustainable business. You're not relying on one, and if one goes bad, you've got others that prop you up. If you have a year where they all sing songs, then you have a great year and you can do something the next year. So the more you can save and be smart, and the more ability you have to take a clip or earn money in non-traditional areas without risk, is a good thing. In a business, and I think this is a business.
Very well. I'd just like to thank Mr. Pryor, or Greg. Thank you for the good work you've done, and thank you for, in advance, for what you're going to continue to do on our audit committee. We appreciate it. Thank you. I now go back to Councillor Pfeiffer. Did you wish to say anything more in moving the motion? No. Seconder was Councillor Bilescu. I'll just put the motion. We've all had a chance to make a comment. All those in favour, raise your hand, please. Thank you. That's carried unanimously. And so we turn to the annual... Oh, beg your pardon, a question, Councillor Telfer? No, what we were suggesting was that... Oh, I thought the comments might have come out during the question session. No? Yes.
Things are distinct from things that perhaps the committee could focus on.
I may have moved to take a vote on that too quickly, but I have. One option is it something that you'd like to raise now? Because the option would be to suspend standing orders just to make sure that everyone is covered for the comments they wish to make about the audit committee.
No.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Those comments can be passed on informally, or perhaps you'll have a chance to make them in one of the debates we're about to have. So apologies for that. And partly, to be honest, humbly saying so, I'm not familiar with this process of going through these financial documents. Obviously, it's the first time as mayor that I've had to do that. So just becoming accustomed to the procedure of having Mr. Connor here and going through these motions. So apologies once again. So now we come to the annual report. That's on... the annual financial statements, rather. On page 71, thank you. So, looking for someone to move accordingly. Councillor Pfeiffer, seconded Councillor Westwood. Councillor Pfeiffer, did you wish to speak?
Just to note that the amount of work that goes into preparing these statements is... quite extraordinary. It's actually quite comparable to the budget setting initially. So I thank the finance team for that, and I also thank our external auditor for a rigorous audit.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood. Councillor Hull.
The South West Regional Waste Resource Authority is in this. I need to ask this question following the interesting answer we got before about... digressing, I guess, in terms of seeking alternative income. that facility down there at Peppers Creek, I think, lends itself to doing a lot of that, particularly if it could be done in conjunction with other councils. You've identified that there's already a electricity generation plant there. I'd like this question taken on notice back to your board as to whether there's scope and possibility of discussions back to council about using this site for other alternative energies, given that a lot of that land can't be built on, and that there's already an identified egress point for electricity from the site. So if that could be taken on board and conveyed back to the board. Okay. All right, I thought you were connected with that. Sorry. Oh, well, there you go. Well, between the two of you, if that could...
Yeah, and I can confirm that Mr. Hindmarsh is already having those ideas and he's looking at how he can use that land.
Right, thank you. So we'll take that as a question and answer. Any other debate or questions? There is just one question I would like to raise. I just have to make sure that I'm on the right motion. Yes, in the financial statements, there's, I think I've got the right document, where in the appendix, it's confusing because there are different appendixes. I think it's Appendix A to Appendix 3. I just wanted to highlight the concerns that were raised by the auditors and ask for an assurance from management about these matters being addressed. Deloitte's noticed issues with petty cash management, the fact that there was no termination policy in place, no formal documented fringe benefit tax procedure used in the preparation of the annual return, and so on. So could I just have the view of management, whether it's Mr. Mifsud or Mr. Connor? Oh, Mr. Barnwell, sorry. Will help us through that. Thank you.
Through the chair, just there the points which were raised as part of the internal control audit. Last year we had up to 12 points which we've addressed, 11 of the points which you've cleared out completely to the Deloitte satisfaction. We have put our responses on page 157 of the report to each of these points, which we will address, and we are committed to addressing each of the points within the coming year.
Very well. I put the motion. All those in favour, raise your hand. All those against, that's carried unanimously. Thank you. And now we go to page 230 of the agenda, investment performance. Did you wish to speak to that? Is it Mr. Mifsud or Mr. Barnwell? Just briefly. Thanks, Mr. Barnwell.
Just the investment report is an annual report which comes back to the audit committee and to council. Just showing our investments are currently the point which the audit committee actually raised, that we currently benchmark our investments against the Reserve Bank cash rate, which for the year was 2.36%, and council has for the 8th consecutive year actually beaten that rate with an average rate of return of 3.08, which gave us an income of 888,000 against an income of 793 for 13-14. Just one point that the audit committee actually raised, that we should maybe benchmark against the commercial banks as well as the Reserve Bank, which we will do in future years. Just really take the report as read, and it's, I'd have to applaud the rest of the finance team, particularly John Stewart, who looks after the treasury management, for his terrific work in the investment portfolio.
Moved, Councillor Pfeiffer.
seconded Councillor. Are you seconding Councillor Hull? You have a question? I'll just see if there's a seconder. Councillor Crossland, please proceed with your question, Councillor Hull.
In terms of the investments, can you indicate to us that all of these investments are both socially and environmentally sound investments that are not in any way capable of causing embarrassment to this council?
I am all the investments throughout the financial year were made invested with the Local Bond Finance Authority, which is a state-backed authority as well. So, and we've also benchmarked any investment over $1 million or 30 days against commercial rates. So we defer testing and benchmarking before we actually invest the funds. And they're fully secured again.
Well, the Local Government Finance Association is subject to an inquiry by the Auditor General at the moment, but I go back to the question. Are there unethical practices that may be linked to where the money is invested? It could be child labour or some environmental damage that could be done. It's one of those questions I've been meaning to ask for a long time as to where our money's earning money on behalf of the city.
Mr. Barnwell.
Yeah, all our funds are invested in accordance with the Treasury Management Policy, which has very strict lines as to where we can invest the funds. So we don't have any funds invested anywhere else except through the LGFA, which is guaranteed by the state government.
Mr. Mayor, can I have that question taken on notice to have it sort of answered with a bit more vigour? Because, you know, the policy...
Yes, could I ask staff to provide an email perhaps to Councillor Hull with the Treasury Management Policy and some helpful information? Would that be all right? Staff will provide you with something more helpful than you can get now, and then you can always take it further. I moved and seconded. All those in favour, raise your hand. I beg your pardon. I thought Councillor Gard was voting in advance. I didn't call the vote, so we're still here. Councillor Gard, please proceed.
Yes, it was just in regard to fixed versus variable and fixed term rates, Mr. Barmel. It's I notice here the comment that no investments were placed for a period greater than 12 months, and I think most of us would be aware that fixed, certainly for longer term, is attractive only depending on whether general interest rates are rising or falling. I'm just wondering whether we have a policy on part of our, for example, fixed term portfolio being for longer than 12 months or not. I notice that the investments fixed for a period of greater than 12 months are to be approved by council, but can you just explain, mainly because of some of our newness, just where we do sit in that thinking?
As I say, any investment longer than 12 months would have to be approved by council, but generally we try, we have maturity dates which would spread over the year, because we obviously our cash flow with our rate revenue happens at different points of the year. We have a peak in the beginning. We have, you know, we have smaller amounts come in later in the year. So we try and make sure that our maturity dates ensure that we have a consistent flow of money through the council to handle the operational needs. So on average, I think we had 72 days was the average maturity for the rates, which is pretty good for the long term, but the short term.
And so that's our main sort of consideration that decision making.
Cash flow. It's actually managing the cash flow throughout the year.
Okay. Thanks.
Were there any other questions or comments? Then I'll put the vote. All those in favour, raise your hand. All those against, that's carried unanimously. Thank you. And now on page 236 of the agenda, we're dealing with the annual corporate performance report. Ms. Harvey, did you want to introduce that? Thank you. Excellent comment. Councillor Telfer.
I'll move as per the recommendation. And I'd like to raise on page 240, number 3, progress towards delivering Council's key project commitments on track against plan 87% and a red light against it. I would like to talk about that because I have some angst about what we as a council are doing. We have strategic priority work. We have worked for over 8 years to decide on 4 sports plans, and we have decided we'd work on the Edwardstown Oval as a priority of those 4 plans. And then we suddenly start, as councillors, moving motions about a whole range of different places and facilities that are not our strategic priorities as such. So if we are working hell for leather to get Edwardstown Oval across the line and to get our other 3 projects across the line that we agreed on, what are we doing by suddenly starting to make motions in all directions on our pet schemes and paying for them on last year's identified savings? It doesn't sit beside this whole thing of trying to get a green light beside our progress towards delivering our key project commitments. And I'm most concerned when, even when we know we want to do something, it can't be considered in our budget reviews, but has to be popped into the leftovers of last year's money. We are starting something very abnormal, which doesn't allow us to balance what we're doing and get on with focusing on our strategic priority work. And I feel very strongly about that. And I guess I'll have to keep working towards an understanding of how we can use our community plans coming down to our work annual area plans and our money linked to that to get our work done that we agree on, rather than suddenly doing bits and pieces that we would like done and which don't sit anywhere.
Thank you. I'd like to just ask a question or pose a rhetorical question for councillors in response. That's entirely right that all of our, ideally all of our projects are in the budget and we approve the budget so we know what we're going to spend and what we're going to spend it on. The rhetorical question is what happens when good ideas come up during the year, and of course it's responsible to find some money to back funding. The alternative would be to simply wait until the next budget. I mean, Councillor Telfer, I'll just give you a chance to perhaps respond to that question. It's a dilemma.
Yeah, it has always been a dilemma, but I think it's not unreasonable to wait till the next quarterly review so that at least those projects are put into some structure, into some place, rather than them leapfrogging to the top over what staff and councillors have spent a long time aligning as their priority.
Seconded, seconded Councillor Pfeiffer, but not choosing to speak. Question from Councillor Westwood.
Yeah, I think we are talking on page 240, are we, or item 3, is it the run? It's just that if it has a red light on it, and it's on track against plan, and that is 87% on track against plan, that's the correct one, isn't it? Why has it got a red light? A red light doesn't seem to go with that.
Yes, thank you, through the Chair. This is the complete report. for 2014-15, and so the red light is due to the fact that the Cove Civic Centre project was delayed by 4 months, and obviously we weren't able to catch that up during the 14-15 year. We are working on bringing through the first quarterly report for 2015-16, so that will then start to track the projects that are on the go for this financial year.
So, question of clarification, what does the 87% mean if it's a red light figure?
Yes, that's right. That doesn't quite answer what I was on about. It's just that I thought that the lights were an indication of the general progress of whatever's on that line. And if it's 87%, it doesn't look like it's about to collapse.
Well, they are, but it's not a university score. Ms Harvey, what does the 87% measure?
Yes, thank you, through the Chair. The 87% measures the amount of the project that was finished. So the target was to finish 100% of the projects within the allotted time for the project. So given the project was 4 months delayed, the relative amount of time over the whole course of the project equated to only 87% of the project being completed.
I wasn't at all complaining. I was just querying the line. Okay.
Look, it was a good question. I've got a follow-up question, actually. Ms Harvey, I don't know whether you'd stake your job on this, but on page 237, KPI number 3, which we were just talking about, the Cove Civic Centre, says the original completion date of March 2015. Now, are you sure the original completion date was March 2015?
Thank you, through the Chair. I would either have to take that question on notice or defer to someone who may be able to answer that question in terms of the project plan from the beginning.
Oh, thank you. Any other staff? Because I reckon I've seen documentation which had a much earlier time frame. Really, can no one tell us when that was meant to be finished? Well, okay, I've seen figures of December 2014, and I think I even saw something much earlier than that when it was first mooted. I was looking at an old city limits from 2012 that I think had a very early completion date expected, but anyway, our staff can get back to us about that.
Councillor Telfer makes some good points, and it's interesting that the projects that she's referring to, the sporting clubs, aren't even mentioned in this because, you know, we're talking about the previous year. So next year the list will be longer rather than the two projects. And the discipline point that Councillor Telfer's raising is a good one, because I've noticed that there has been a bit of a slip in the discipline, that there has been some almost gratuitous endeavours by some of our colleagues, and it's not really a trend that I'd like to see continue, because it means that the rule book goes out and we all have a go, and then it becomes a bit of a mess. For example, leading up to the last election, I raised concern about prioritisation of major projects. And I was chuffed to see that there was some intention to go down that pathway. I've seen that drop. I've seen us drop our game a bit with that one. And in fact, we've got more projects now than we did before the election. And there's been other things happen as well. And really, you know, it has crossed my mind, well, why should I actually take the responsible approach and hold back with the Plaza project over here in front of the library? Why shouldn't I just go for it like everybody else? And be involved in the free-for-all. I don't really want to do that. I would like to see a more considered and responsible approach to the major projects. So basically what I'm saying is that I think we really need to just stand back and have a look at what our strategic projects are, resist the temptation to indulge, because it is being monitored by a number of us.
More comments? Councillor Vlescu.
Look, I thank Councillor Telfer and Councillor Hull for raising those concerns about what one could term unorthodox approaches to savings. I think what it identifies is that there are some short-term funding gaps that council feels they do need to be be addressed before the budget process and outside the budget process. But it is important that we keep within that. So perhaps for the next, maybe we can look at how we can address these the next time around. So, you know, do we look at certain criteria for these sort of things? Do we have a limit in the overall spend? That sort of thing. Because I guess what happens is when things are looked at outside the budget process, they are questioned more. We might have descriptions of them like we did in the previous council, which, you know, flights of fancy and things like that, and that wasn't helpful. So I think if we have some criteria, then we can approach this in a more responsible manner. But identifying that there are some things that are going to come up, there is the money there, do we miss out on taking action in order to be sticklers to those rules? Or do we have some flexibility to travel outside those boundaries, but in a responsible way?
Councillor Gard.
Yes, first of all, thanks for a very informative report. I think it would be nice if all organisations could produce something as succinct as that on their general corporate performance. I just had just a quick spate of comments, really, or questions, if you could bear with me, members. The first one was regarding marketing planning as a part of our overall planning process. I'm not yet fully conversant on where it fits in, whether it comes in as part of business planning or whether it's subsidiary to business planning. Quite commonly, marketing planning comes in to a business plan of a large organisation, and then there are sub-branches for that according to products, etc. So that was the first question. And then just a few comments. Just from the point of view of helpfulness to the reader, in KPI 4, whether percentages could be applied to the figures. KPI 5, if the perhaps the exceptions, it was a 95% delivery of council resolutions, so perhaps the exceptions could be listed. KPI 6. I was just interested in the means of measurement there, and I would have thought perhaps just a one-liner, two-liners for the purpose of the report. KPI 8, could the results of the review of that exercise come back to council? And KPI 9, I was curious to know why no target was set for the personal leave, just as an indicative target. These small things, really, collectively.
Thanks, through the chair. I'll just go through them in order. In terms of the marketing planning process, it may be useful for council to consider that discussion when they have their strategic planning discussion, which I believe is scheduled for the January forum that you'll be having, so perhaps how that might fall into that process would be useful then. Certainly the comments around KPI 4 and 5, certainly we can build all of those into the report. And the final one around KPI 9, there was no target set for that one because it was a KPI that was asked to be introduced during the year, and just to get the baseline information in the first instance, and I think council were to consider whether they wanted to continue tracking that KPI.
Thanks very much. Again, I'm very thankful for that report. I think it's a very useful report as a basis for future discussion. It's one that we shouldn't take lightly.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Now, it was seconded in the end, wasn't it? Then I put it to the vote. All those in favour, raise your hand. I was against, that's carried unanimously. Thank you, members. We